Axis Mundi.
Welcome to One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew L. Seidel, a constitutional attorney and the author of The Founding Myth and American Crusade. This is a podcast about religion, the law, and the battle for America's soul. We'll be separating church and state, defending freedom and equality, and fighting Christian nationalism. If you haven't already, sign up for our weekly bonus content and ad-free listening at accessmundi.us. LFG, folks. Hello, my friends. I am back from hiatus, from a vacation, from out of office, from being offline, and there is fuckery afoot. In Downton Abbey, Lady Mary is the prim, proper English gentlewoman. And that is how I think of Michelle Dockery, the actress who played Lady Mary on Downton Abbey. She does it so well. Wonderful show. Really, and highly recommend rewatching it on the PBS schedule so you only allow yourself to watch one episode every Sunday night. Stretch it out. Don't binge it. It's worth it, trust me. But when Dockery plays, rather brilliantly, opposite Matthew McConaughey in a Guy Ritchie movie, because of her role as Lady Mary, some of her lines land with additional oomph and heft. They jar the viewer who is used to seeing Dockery playing Lady Mary prim and proper. And this, I mean, we're talking a Guy Ritchie movie here, right? They're dropping F-bombs all the time. People are dying left and right. Violence. It's Guy Ritchie. And the best line that Dockery, well, I mean, she has actually some really good lines, and I enjoy that movie. But the best, and just beautifully delivered, is when Dockery says,
"There's fuckery afoot."
And I am recording on a beautiful Sunday morning, skipping church, as is my wont. And folks, there is fuckery afoot. Trump is attacking atheists in a way that everybody is just saying, oh, it's just a joke, because you're allowed to joke about atheists in a way that you're not allowed to joke about any other religion. Trump's IRS is attempting to repeal a federal law that protects the integrity of our charitable institutions, of our 501c3s, and of our elections. No surprise there. The Supreme Court is greenlighting the destruction of public education, and there is a new kind of terrible when it comes to Trump's judicial appointees. So let's get into it.
There's fuckery afoot.
People in this room are amazing. I even, looking at that list, I really said, that's something. That's something great. And you're all believers. I think, Paula, you wouldn't have invited people that were not a lot of. Is there an atheist in the room? Any atheists? I don't think so. I wouldn't want to raise my hand if I were. I'd be in big trouble. No, you invited all people that are outstanding in faith and success, and it's a very noble group.
There's fuckery afoot.
So that was spun as a joke, and it was treated as kind of a positive, fun moment in the media. But that is not a positive. That is a problem. For a number of reasons. First of all, this is indicative of the problem that atheists can't be successful, can't be public leaders. This was said to a group of CEOs and business leaders. And the event itself, as Trump kind of alludes there, if you watch the whole clip, you can see this more, was organized by the White House Faith Office that Paula White, the noted Christian grifter, runs. And the CEOs were supposedly selected because they donated to religious charities. But, I mean, who knows what that means? Both from the White House Faith Office criteria side and for what their reasons for such donations were. And what I mean by that is you often find that business leaders, for instance, donate to both political parties. They'll donate to candidates on both sides. And we don't know what kind of criteria Paula White's office is selecting these folks for. Are they just picking people who are donating to Christian charities? Is this other faith charities? There's not a lot of information out there on that. And you could easily see some of these CEOs just donating to a friend's charity that happens to run it. There's a whole bunch of reasons, right? It doesn't necessarily mean they're these deep believers. And I also think of the Clergy Project. And if you're not familiar with the Clergy Project is a really fascinating and interesting initiative that Linda LaScola and Daniel Dennett pulled together with some help from Dan Barker at the Freedom From Religion Foundation and others to help members of the clergy, like we're talking like preachers in the pulpit here, who no longer believe in what they're, not just no longer believe, but are atheists. We're talking about atheists in the pulpit who are bound by beliefs that they no longer hold because of other ties, not ties of belief, but ties of community and career and family and livelihood, ties that they cannot sever because they've organized their entire lives around this one idea that they now realize is wrong and about which they have changed their minds. And the Clergy Project helps these folks, one, just with that mental and emotional burden, which is significant. You know, they're essentially living a lie and don't feel like there's a way to escape. But it also does try to help them escape, tries to help them get job training and also provides a community for them to get advice from other folks who are in the exact same situation. And I always think about the Clergy Project when at moments like this, because again, who knows how many people in that room have doubts or are not really religious, or more to the point, feel like they have to portray themselves as religious to be successful in business or politics. I mean, there are 535 members of Congress, and really only Representative Jared Huffman, who I admire and consider a friend, is the only one who's openly not religious, rejects religion openly. And that's just so vastly disproportionate to what the numbers suggest for the overall population, where you're talking about like a quarter of the country is non-religious. And even if you just look at atheists and agnostics, you're talking about 7% there, but still you're talking, that'd be 35 plus members of Congress that would be atheist and agnostic if Congress were representative, which of course it's not. It skews male, it skews white, it skews older, and it skews heavily Christian. But who knows what that actually means? That skew means that these politicians feel like they must adopt religion outwardly to be successful, to hold public office. Now, you know, if this situation, had I been in there, I'm not the kind of person who's ever going to be a business leader. Making a whole lot of money is not just something that really interests me, but I would have proudly raised my hand and said, yeah, I'm an atheist. I'd love to get into a conversation publicly about that with Donald Trump or Paula White or any of these folks. And that sad scene and the pressure that everybody recognized exists, that was taken as a given in that room, the expectation that nobody could possibly be an atheist. And again, specific situation there, organized by the White House Faith Office. But that is one reason that I've always said that I don't think it's just something we should do in terms of atheists coming out of the closet. I think it's something we have to do. In fact, I think that if you are able to safely come out of the closet as an atheist, that you have a duty to do that for the people who can't, for the people whose livelihood, whose family, whose career really is dependent on keeping that secret, so that we can get to the point where that pressure, that expectation that was so clearly on display at that moment in the White House is not a given. So I have long said that if you can come out of the closet as an atheist, that it is your duty to do so. And I do mean can as in can do so safely. I think that is an important part of that. It's also worth pointing out that actually everybody in that room is an atheist about some gods, about many gods. And this is something that I've always found fascinating when I talk to other believers. They can articulate such good, cogent arguments against other gods. You know, you ask a Christian who was born and raised in the American South why they believe the way they do, get into the nitty-gritty with them, and you know, you ask somebody who was born and raised in the American South, a Christian, raised in the church, taken to Sunday school, all that stuff. You know, you ask them to articulate arguments against, you know, somebody who is holds a Hindu belief or the Hindu gods or Allah, and they can do so. But asking them to then turn and apply that same rationale to their own religion is where they tend to fall down. And you can see that happening in this room where people are being made to... Atheists are always made to feel ashamed in this country. And it's one of the things we see come through on a number of sociological studies, that atheists are among the least trusted people in this country, that they are among the most hated groups of people in this country. And we've actually seen those numbers tick up, and we've seen improvement on that over the last decade or so as we've been asking people to come out of the closet if they can. And I think it's important to adopt that rule, atheist. And in fact, I'm going to probably have to do a whole episode sometime about atheist and agnostic. And there's this thing that always happens where when I get into some debates with my liberal Christian friends, who I love dearly and who, you know, we align on all the values, one of the things that I often hear is they're like, well, why aren't you, you know, an agnostic? You're really more of an agnostic. And it's like, well, yeah, I'm an agnostic too. But I'm not afraid to draw a conclusion because I don't have 100% complete and total information on any number of issues, like including things like, I think this is a good place to actually bring in the tooth fairy, right? Like I don't have complete and total information to disprove the existence of a tooth fairy, but all the information I do have suggests that no tooth fairy exists. So I'm comfortable saying no tooth fairy exists. But a lot of people are not comfortable making that extra step and adopting the atheist label when it comes to God. And that is because of the societal pressure that exists that you can see in this Trump moment. I think I'm going to have to do a whole episode on that, because there is, and it comes, I think, from an okay place, from a good place, but it is a place of self-protection, where I hear from some of my Christian friends, again, like, well, maybe you're really just an agnostic, Andrew. Maybe you're not really an atheist. And this has become trite when it comes to Trump. And it's something that you can do with so many of the situations with Trump. It's just a trite notion. But just imagine, imagine Trump had said this about some other group, like Jews, or even tried to joke about another group's beliefs, another religious group's belief. And yes, of course, atheists are not a religious group. You all know what I'm talking about here. And the furor that would have been rained down. I don't know if that was a Freudian slip or if I just mispronounced things because I'm battling this little cold that y'all can probably hear. Just imagine what that would have looked like. Or imagine if, you know, Obama had mocked atheists in this way. What would have been done to him? Probably nothing, because it's typically okay. But imagine mocking another minority group like this. In this country, atheists are still the acceptable butt of many jokes and outright mockery. It's okay for public officials and leaders to openly mock atheists, and the media will treat it as a joke. I do think it's worth remembering, and it seems that Christians have forgotten this, that we have pretty good evidence that Trump secretly mocks his Christian supporters. In fact, that is a title to an article written in The Atlantic by McKay Coppins, Trump Secretly Mocks His Christian Supporters, that was published back in 2020, but it talks about all of these people in the Trump orbit who spoke on the record to McKay Coppins about the way that Trump mocks and has, quote, spoken with cynicism and contempt about believers. There's this one exchange that Coppins recounts about Creflo Dollar, who is one of these prosperity gospel preachers like Paula White, who was telling his flock that they had to get him a private jet, a Gulfstream, if I recall correctly. And Trump was, quote, delighted by the scam, according to this story by McKay Coppins, and eager to highlight that the pastor was full of shit. Another quote, eager to highlight that the pastor was full of shit. Trump added that, quote, they're all hustlers. So Trump will mock atheists in public and his devout Christian followers in private. But what bothers me most is that this event makes an utter mockery of America's best idea, the separation of church and state. And speaking about the separation of church and state, let's talk about the Johnson Amendment for a moment. You all saw this in the news. This happened while I was offline. So here's what happened in a nutshell. There is a federal lawsuit going on where a group of religious broadcasters and churches has sued the IRS over this really important, long-standing rule. And Trump's IRS has said, we're going to settle this lawsuit in a way that makes churches exempt from the federal law that we're talking about. And that federal law is the Johnson Amendment. So let me explain to you what's going on with this rule. Charitable donations should go to charitable works. That's the Johnson Amendment. When somebody makes a donation to charity, to a 501c3, to a house of worship, that donation should go to charity, should go to charitable works. When you donate to a group like Americans United for Separation of Church and State, it should go to the mission of that group. When you donate to the food kitchen down the street, to Goodwill, the donation should go to the work, the charitable work that that group is doing. For everything you have heard around this rule over the last couple of weeks, that is how simple the rule is. Charitable giving should fund charitable work, not political campaigns. That's it. Everybody I know agrees with this. Charitable giving should fund charitable work, not political campaigns. But there is a small, vocal minority that has been trying for decades to repeal this common sense rule. And they claim it's all about free speech and religious freedom, but it is not. It is about money and power. So let's peel back the next layer. The Johnson Amendment is the rule that ensures nonprofits, including churches, do not abuse a really valuable government privilege. Because tax exemption is a very valuable government privilege. And it's a privilege, not a right. Tax exemption is a privilege, not a right. And just like any other privilege, the government can attach strings to it. And one of those strings is the Johnson Amendment. And it says that every charity cannot endorse or oppose candidates for political office. Why? Because charitable donations should go to charitable works, not political campaigns. That's it. That's all. Do not take a stance on partisan political campaigns. It's really important to note that churches are fully permitted to talk about and engage on issues and nonpartisan lobbying. They can talk about gay marriage. They can talk about abortion. They can talk about civil rights. They just can't tell you who to vote for. They can engage on issues. Every C3 in the country can engage on issues. Every church in the country can engage on issues. This rule was passed more than 70 years ago in 1954. It did not stop, and it did not mean to stop. It was never intended to stop Martin Luther King Jr. from preaching civil rights from the pulpit. And by the way, nor did it stop many, many, many conservative white churches in the South from opposing King and the civil rights movement. The Johnson Amendment simply means that tax-exempt organizations cannot abuse their tax-exempt privilege by endorsing a candidate for political office or engaging in partisan politics. You don't get to take money that somebody donated to charity and use it to win an election. That's it. And this rule applies to all charities, all C3. It doesn't single out churches. It doesn't pick on churches. But this settlement agreement that Trump's IRS is trying to force down our throats would just exempt churches and just houses of worship. And really, because it's a settlement agreement, just the churches in this case, though, we know that won't stand for very long. And it's important to note that there's one other sort of aspect to this rule, is that it's only talking about churches and charities and their representatives when they're acting in their official capacity. So for instance, when I am acting in my day job, where I run comms for a 501c3 nonprofit, I can't engage in partisan politicking. But I'm here at home on my own podcast, and I can tell you that you should never vote for another Republican again in your life. That they have utterly destroyed American democracy, and that that entire party should go down in flames and be buried on the ash heap of history. And that Donald Trump is the worst president, and that anybody he endorses should be ridden out of this country on a rail. But anybody who works for a church or is a preacher at a church or works at a charity or leads a charity, they are free to tell their friends and their family what they think about elections. They're free to talk about it on their personal social media. They just can't do it from the pulpit or from the official letterhead of their church or organization. I mean, if you follow me, you know that I talk about politics relentlessly on my social media. I just don't do it while I represent my C3 organization in my day job. And to take that one step further, if a nonprofit or a church really wants to endorse a political candidate, it can. It absolutely can. They have that ability. They have that freedom. They just have to, like everybody else, pay taxes. That's the rub here. They want to have their cake and eat it too. They want to be able to wade into any political campaign and keep their tax exemption. And this is not the way things work in this country. And the second highest court in the land has already decided that. There's a case called Branch Ministries versus Rosati that's been on the books for a long time. It says that this rule does not burden free speech or religious exercise, that it's perfectly acceptable. And the rule itself is wildly, wildly popular, including among many believers. There's a Lifeway Research poll, and Lifeway Research is an evangelical polling group. Their slogan is Biblical Solutions for Life. And Lifeway Research found that 80% of Americans oppose pastors endorsing a candidate in church, and 75% oppose churches publicly endorsing candidates. And if you remember back in Trump's first term, he promised to utterly destroy the Johnson Amendment. We saw how popular the rule was then. 4,000 faith leaders from diverse backgrounds asked Congress to protect the rule. 6,000 nonprofits wrote a letter to Congress asking it to protect the rule. 100 different religious denominations and organizations asked Congress to protect the rule. Everybody likes this rule, except for Donald Trump and this really small group of Christian nationalists that orbit him. And the reason for that is because Donald Trump is a transactional person. Everything operates on a quid pro quo for him. I'll give you this, you give me that. And he found out during the run-up to the 2016 election that these pastors could not officially endorse him when he asked for it, when he wanted it. And they found out, oh, We can get this guy to kill this rule that we have long hated if we tell him that. I mean, we know this. You can go back and look at the historical record here. Donald Trump met with a bunch of these basically white evangelicals, mostly for the most part, found out, oh, they can't endorse me, so I'm going to destroy this rule. That's where it comes from. It's transactional. But it's worse than we all think. Rachel Lazar, president and CEO of Americans United, went on MSNBC this past weekend and said that this would make this would be like Citizens United on steroids, and she is absolutely right. And that's because the push to repeal and gut and end and utterly destroy the Johnson Amendment is not about freedom. It is about money and power. And the reason this would be so bad for American politics is because, unlike every other 501c3 in the country, churches do not report any financial information to the IRS. Every other charity in this country has to file a Form 990 or file some kind of financial disclosure with the IRS. They track every penny that comes in and every penny that goes out, but not churches. Churches are financial black holes. We have no idea what kind of money comes in and goes out. They don't report anything to the IRS. And if you pair that with the gutting of this rule that keeps churches out of partisan politics, you all of a sudden have a recipe for something that is so much worse than Citizens United. You have a recipe for unregulated, unaccountable, opaque super PACs housed in houses of worship, in churches. Think about an Elon Musk-level mega donor who could form or write a check to the nearest church for any amount. He can earmark that donation for politicking. He can take a tax write-off because he has donated it to a charity. Meanwhile, the church can then turn around and spend that donation on anything, including political campaigns. Churches will become super PACs, unregulated, unaccountable, opaque super PACs. And I do think this creates an incentive structure so that we would see PACs reorganizing as churches. We would see people like Elon Musk has just started an entirely new, well, he claims to have, political party. You think he's above starting a church? Hell, he could probably mix his drug use with this church and the politicking. Now he can fund tax deductible a massive attack on American elections. And by the way, all of that reality, which is likely coming, that's also going to lead to government regulation of churches. So gutting this popular common sense rule is going to be far worse for our democracy and society than Citizens United. It is going to gift this Christian nationalist fringe a scary amount of political power, and that's their goal. And it's really just simple. We should ensure that charitable donations are going to charitable work and that this rule is worthy of our esteem and protection.
There's fuckery afoot.
So what's actually happening with that case? Well, Americans United for Separation of Church and State has intervened or tried to intervene in that lawsuit. There's a press release on the Americans United website, AU.org, that you can go read about that. We also have that lawsuit up on the AU website if you want to understand more. So because Trump and these churches and these religious broadcasters are effectively agreeing to this settlement, we're arguing that there needs to be somebody who understands the value of this rule and opposes it involved in the lawsuit, and AU is wading in to try to do that. I also want to take a moment because Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, who is not related to the Johnson Amendment in any way, and in fact hates it, wrote what he called an op-ed, but was up on his Twitter page. It's a tweet or an X or whatever the fuck we're calling these things these days. It's not an op-ed, my man. Anyway, he put an op-ed. He put a post. He tweeted out a screed about the Johnson Amendment. And there's a ton of Christian nationalist bullshit in it. And we're gonna read just a couple of things in here because I think it's worth doing. He talks about Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Jefferson's letter to the Banbury He talks about Thomas Jefferson and the letter that Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptists, in which Jefferson says that he contemplates with solemn reverence that act of the whole American people, which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. And Johnson quotes some of that. And then he says, quote, Jefferson clearly did not mean that metaphorical wall was to keep religion from influencing issues of civil government. To the contrary, it was meant to keep the federal government from impeding the religious practice of citizens. The founders wanted to protect the church from an encroaching state, not the other way around. And I have to say that this is one of the dumbest arguments against the separation of church and state. Walls separate. There is no such thing as a one-way wall. They desperately want this to be true, that the founders thought religion should be in the government, but not the other way around. And it is an insult to the founders' best idea. It's also absurd. It is absurd to think that Thomas Jefferson would have chosen the metaphor of a wall if that is what he believed. But this is a guy who penned the Declaration of Independence, and we think that he chose a metaphor that doesn't work, that makes no sense. There is no such thing as a one-way wall. A wall keeps both. Get the fuck out of here with that, Mike Johnson. I also think it's worth noting, as I've written in a law review article, that the Supreme Court adopted the wall metaphor in 1878 and employed it in 1947, 1948, 1961 three times, 1962, 1963, 1968, 1973, 1977, 1982, and then again and again and again in countless concurrences and dissents and many lower court opinions. Johnson goes on to say, they being the founders, quote, very deliberately listed religious liberty, the free exercise of religion, as the first freedom protected in the Bill of Rights. No, they did not. First of all, there are other freedoms protected in the Constitution. We did have a whole episode on habeas corpus, which is a right that is written into the text of the Constitution itself, not in the amendments, which are what we call the Bill of Rights, but which came along later. And even if you do just look at the Bill of Rights, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, we have long, not that long, but we have for some time broken the First Amendment into the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That's the Establishment Clause. And that comes before the Free Exercise Clause or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So even if you want to say that the Bill of Rights is the list of our first freedoms, it's not the free exercise of religion that is first, but the secular government guarantee that is first. Partly because you cannot have freedom of religion without a government that is free from religion. If you want true religious liberty, you've got to have a secular government. That's why it reads the way it does. And also, it's just worth noting, that wasn't first, because it was most important. In fact, it was third. The First and the Second Amendments that were proposed did not make it into the final, so they weren't first. I get it. I love it, too. I've said it, but it's just... Johnson goes on and gets into George Washington declared that the religion and morality are indispensable sports. John Adams warned directly, our Constitution is made for a moral and religious people. Again, when I dropped the episode a while back about these exact quotes, the George Washington quote, the John Adams quote, and proved beyond any doubt that these show that Christian nationalism is not just morally, but intellectually bankrupt. And in fact, these quotes disprove what Mike Johnson is trying to show here. They actually prove that the founders did not base the United States government on Christian principles. This is why I devoted an entire episode to shredding this Christian nationalist argument, specifically about those two quotes. It's because these two quotes have a massive impact today. Yeah, they're from the founding. But this talking point of theirs, we can disprove the central claim of Christian nationalism when we look at it. And this is central to the Christian nationalist identity. So if you've not listened, that's episode 17 about these religion and morality quotes. Please share it. Please listen. Please learn that argument. Cut Johnson and these other Christian nationalists down when they try to do it. I'm not going to do the rest of Mike Johnson's, but I will point out that the Johnson Amendment is a federal law that Donald Trump is trying to rewrite and give churches a pass, an exemption from, which they don't have, including in the text of that law, by settling a case. This is just another end run around the law, another example of the lawlessness of this Trump administration.
There's fuckery afoot.
Okay, we're going to do two other things. We're going to do these a little bit faster. We got to do an education roundup because the Department of Education is in serious trouble. As you know, Donald Trump and Linda McMahon have promised to destroy the Department of Education. Remember that Jerry Falwell hoped to see the day when we don't have public schools, the churches will have taken them over, and Christians will be running them. Destroying public education has long been a goal of the Christian nationalist movement. And I tell the story about this in American Crusade, how big part of that came about after Brown versus Board of Education, when it was required that we have desegregated public schools. But there's another reason why nowadays. The attacks on public education, especially vouchers were invented to undo Brown versus Board of Education. But there is a new gloss that has been given to that for Christian nationalists and believers, because that racism is not acceptable on the face. It's not okay to voice that kind of racism these days. And again, I get into the why of this. Go read American Crusade, the chapter on education. You'll see what I mean. But there's another quote that I think sums up the new gloss that the Christian nationalists have given, and which has worked its way into many, many churches. And Tara Westover recounts it in her best-selling memoir, Educated. She writes, "Dad said public school was a ploy by the government to lead children away from God. I may as well surrender my kids to the devil himself," he said, "as send them down the road to that school." Because public schools cannot abuse their power to inculcate and indoctrinate children into Christianity, they are leading children away from God in the eyes of the Christian nationalist movement. And that is why they hate public education. I know we love to say, and it's one of the most popular arguments you'll see online, that they don't want to see an educated electorate. And I think certainly part of that is true. But remember, Betsy DeVos said that her family promoted vouchers and school choice to, quote, "help advance God's kingdom." And she also said, quote, "the church, which ought to be, in our view, far more central to the life of the community, has been displaced by the public school as the center of activity." It's that education leads kids away from Christianity. It's that the existence of public schools takes people away from churches and church schools. Catherine Stewart, good friend, wrote in The Power Worshippers that for many supporters of this movement, quote, "the underlying motive for voucher programs is not to improve education, but to eliminate non-sectarian education." That's what they're after. They want to destroy public education. That's why. And Trump's attempt to destroy the public education by having McMahon fire thousands of employees at the Department of Education has been challenged, right? There's a lawsuit about this. And that's the central question in the case that you heard about last week. The real question is, can the executive branch, the president, undo entirely something that the legislative branch, Congress, has legislated and funded? Does the president have the power to undo an act of Congress, right? Because Congress passed a bunch of laws that created the Department of Education, that dictated what the Department of Education should do, and then funded that mission. If you're wondering what the Department of Education does, by the way, it does not direct local education. It's not in charge of curriculum. It deals with money, so it funds student loans, and doles out a bunch of money for public schools, for various programs in public schools. And then it looks at data. It collects a bunch of information so we can see how to improve our public schools. So funds student loans, funds programs in public schools, collects data. And then finally, it does civil rights enforcement in public schools, right? It prevents public schools from, you know, racial, ableist, gender, sex, religious discrimination. Okay, those are the four things it does. Does the president have the power to undo an act of Congress that created that agency, that gave it that mission, and that funded that mission? And the answer to that is no, of course not. We have a separation of powers. The whole point is that you can't do that. I mean, this is a basic thing in administrative law. We took a whole class on administrative law in law school. This is one of the things you learn about. If Congress decides to set up an agency with within the executive doesn't just get to destroy it. So Congress passes laws saying we want to give students loans. We want to protect students with disabilities. We want to leave X and Y and Z, and we want to fund those things. It is the Department of Education's job to do that. And it's the executive's job to make that happen, not to undermine it, not to say no thank you. We're going to use that money for something else. That's unconstitutional. That's actually called impoundment, where Congress earmarks and pays out a bunch of money to the executive to do A, B, C, and the executive takes it and says, no thanks, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. And the reason that this is happening is because we have such a weak and feckless Congress. Because the Republicans will do anything to appease Trump. They are, bootlickers does not begin to cover it. Anyway, this is what the ongoing case is about. Can the president do this even though Congress appropriated this money to fund the Department of Education? And there's, within that case, there's Trump firing thousands of Department of Education employees. Now, normally in ongoing litigation, when there is a case happening and the case is questioning the validity of an action, which we're going to oversimplify as destroying the Department of Education, during litigation, the courts would strive to maintain the status quo. In other words, they want to keep things as they are, especially if changing things would be completely devastating to the case and would effectively decide the outcome of the case, right? Like, take it out of something completely different. Like, let's say you're arguing over who owns a car for whatever reason. Junkyard says, no, we own the car. The person who bought the car, maybe let's say they defaulted on a loan, says, no, I still own it. And the junkyard wants to is going to strip it for parts and sell it off to get their money. Okay. In that case like that, the court is probably going to say, no, listen, until we figure out what happened here, until we can get to the bottom of this and who really does own the car, and until we can answer these underlying questions, you don't get to strip the car for parts. Because what's the point of answering the underlying questions when the car is already destroyed? Right. So we're going to enjoin that. We're going to say, nope, you can't. You can do that if later on, if you win, but you can't do that now. Right. We're going to figure out the answers to the important questions first. Then you can go ahead and do that. So we're going to enjoin. We're going to issue an injunction. We're going to stop you from doing that now. And that's what it effectively happened, because Donald Trump fired thousands of employees at the Department of Education, which would effectively destroy the department and all of the work that it was doing. And a lower federal judge said, hey, no, we're not going to let that happen yet. We're going to figure out what's going on. And then maybe you can do it after we've figured that out. And the Supreme Court let that happen. Supreme Court said, no, go ahead, Trump. Donald Trump, please. We would not deign to get in your way. We humble, berobed bitches would not stand in your way of doing anything. And some of you are thinking, Andrew, what are you talking about? Because you already did the Supreme Court roundup episode. I know the Supreme Court term ended. You said at the end of that that they were going to go off on their jets and their private yachts and be with their billionaire buddies. How is this even happening? They adjourned for the summer. The justices are gone. How do you get a decision in a case like this that allows Donald Trump to fire all these people when the court's not there? What are you talking about? The Supreme Court decided something. The Supreme Court decided it on the shadow docket. On the emergency docket. You've probably heard about the shadow docket. I highly recommend Professor Stephen Vladeck's book called The Shadow Docket if you want to learn more about this. There is a procedure at the Supreme Court where for emergency questions, the court can weigh in outside of their regular docket. The best example of something like this would be like in a death penalty case, where the state is about to execute somebody who's got a remaining constitutional claim, and the state's getting ready to execute them, you know, say that night, and this person needs relief immediately. That's what it used to be like, and it used to be that shadow docket and emergency docket decisions were very, very rare, and that's because the case is not developed at all. There's no oral argument. There's very few briefs filed on this. The justices don't have a lot of time to wait on. They need to act quickly. And so no real big decisions, no decisions that alter the structure and face of American law, of our jurisprudence, should happen on the shadow docket. But this court, this power-hungry court, this corrupt court, this captured court, does not give a flying fuck about that. They care about exercising their power. And one of the worst parts about shadow docket decisions is that there are no opinions. The justices just decide the case. There's no reasoning. There's no rationale. And I think that's part of the reason they chose this method for this case is because there is no possible rationale for allowing Donald Trump to gut the Department of Education now while a case is ongoing to decide whether he has the power to gut the Department of Education. Nothing can make this make sense. It shows just again how far this court is willing to go and how broken this institution is. Remember back when you were a kid being told that you couldn't do something, and then being a kid, you asked why. You know, I'm a dad, I've got three boys, I hear this all the time. And I refuse to give that most unsatisfying and unjust of all answers because I said so. But it's something that we all have heard as a kid, and I'm sure we've even said it. I try never to give it. I mean, I can tell you that this is, as a child, this is one of the things that irked me the most. And it's one of the things that made me who I am today. I rarely got that answer from my parents. And when I got it elsewhere in school from a coach, from a scout leader, I was kicked out of the Boy Scouts. I challenged it. It is not a reason. It is the exercise of raw power. Because I said so is the exercise of power, not a reason. And sometimes you need that. There's maybe an instance where your kid's like, I don't know, doing something super dangerous, but you just need them to stop, and then you can explain it later, right? But that's not what's happening here. This is just an exercise of raw power by the U.S. Supreme Court. And all of these things that we're talking about today, folks, are related. We're talking about empowering Donald Trump and the Christian nationalist movement in this country to privilege the chosen few, the straight, white, conservative, heterosexual Christian men. Right? Not atheists. God, no. No, 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 no. Anything to empower the straight, white, conservative Christian men. That's what the common thread running through all of these different things is. Repealing the Johnson Amendment, mocking atheists in a ceremony, in an event that is made to tear down the wall of separation between church and state, which is also what the Johnson Amendment is doing in gutting the Department of Education. It all advances Christian nationalism. And lastly, I want to talk about, as bad as the Supreme Court is, it could and will get worse. And that's because the Senate Judiciary voted to advance Emile Bove, who is essentially like one of Donald Trump's henchmen, like a fixer of the worst kind. Like, you think some of the worst stuff that happened, this guy feels like one of those characters out of Watergate. Does not care about what the law says, what the law does, or what it should do. Emile Bove said that the DOJ might just have, Trump's DOJ might just have to say fuck you to court orders. Right? This man is the source of some of the worst lawlessness in the Trump administration. There was a damning whistleblower report out about Bove. That's where the fuck you comes from. And I want everybody to call their senators and tell them to vote against this just absolutely terrible person, especially if you are in North Carolina and Tom Tillis is your senator. I do not understand why Tom Tillis, who has announced his retirement and is supposedly fed up with MAGA, is going along with this. He's on the Senate Judiciary and caved. But this person is so openly corrupt. I haven't even mentioned, but go look at the deal that he cut with Mayor of New York Eric Adams to effectively avoid prosecution, to really understand the depths of this man's corruption. And he, putting somebody like that on the federal bench is different than putting some of these Christian nationalist ideologues on the bench, people like Matthew Kaczmarek, who are absolutely terrible appointees and doing massive, massive damage. This is terrible in a different way. In a way that is perhaps not something that we can recover from. And lowering the bar that far, removing the bar, or perhaps even changing the bar so that it has to be somebody who is loyal to Trump to the point of saying that the Department of Justice has to say fuck you to court orders, really changes the calculus for people who want to get on the Supreme Court under Donald Trump. That's the scary part here. Because there are tons of judges on the federal bench, the Fifth Circuit in particular, that are trying out to be the next Supreme Court justice and thinking that Donald Trump is going to get to do an appointment, right? Maybe Thomas is going to retire, maybe Alito is going to retire, maybe one of them will die, and maybe a spot will open up. Who's Trump going to pick? I mean, this guy would almost certainly be Trump's top choice because couldn't ask for somebody more loyal. And if you've got dirt on somebody, that's even better. Which, somebody who's doing your dirty work, you have dirt on each other. This is terrible in a different way, folks. I don't know which is worse, but you need to call your senators and tell them to move against Emile Bove. And I think the votes are going to be coming soon. I don't know the date as of this recording, but especially if you're in North Carolina, get on Tom Tillis's phone. This is terrible in a different way. There's a whole lot of fuckery afoot.
There's fuckery afoot.
And I will continue to do what I can to educate you about it. As always, if you've got questions, find me on socials. Hit me up. Let me know. Thank you all for the support. This has been One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew Seidel. Until next time.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.